The French have arrived. They drank at the oak spring. They were not afraid. They tied their horses and planted the stakes. The Imazirin, while they are numerous, it is just as if they do not exist. These are the hunting words of a blind Amazigh poetess from Atlas al-Mutawassit, who lived during the early 20th century, and whose verses calling people to resist French colonial rule in Morocco cut through collective memory like a blade. But the question remains to be entirely answered. Who was she, and how come her poetry echoes with such intensity? She was blind, yet she perceived people's weaknesses with a disturbing clarity. She was illiterate, yet she voiced truths that no one else had the courage to speak. She was a woman, yet she encouraged and led men to battle with a fervor unmatched by any man of her tribe. This is the story of Tougret Ould Aïssa. Hi, my name is Aya Choukri, and on this channel, I share the stories of the people who made Moroccan history, for better or for worse. Here are the video chapters if you'd like to focus on a particular part, but I'd highly suggest you stick around for the whole thing. Make sure to like and subscribe to support my work if you like it, and without further ado, let's open that portal, shall we? Before we dive into it, I thought it'd be useful to quickly go over some key elements of context. Namely, the French protectorate over Morocco. In 1912, the Treaty of Fès was signed, making Morocco a protectorate of France and Spain. As if one color wasn't enough. What does that mean? Basically, France was in charge of running the whole territory, absolutely everything, but they kept the appearance that the Sharifian kingdom was still independent, requiring the Sultan's signatures and whatnot. The claim that was made is that they were all about modernizing Morocco, a vision that the central power, the Makhzen as we call it, was more than happy to jump on board with. Back then, it was a great deal, truly, for them. As they got the military support they needed to deal with the uprisings of the tribes from Bled Siba, the rural areas in Morocco. Also, let's be real, the Makhzen didn't have much of a choice. After the heavy military and economic losses they suffered at the end of the 19th century, plus France already had police rights in Morocco since 1906, it was a whole shebang. I'll give the full rundown in other videos. All that to say, for the Makhzen, the central power, the French protectorate was more about survival than it was about a vision. As a counterpart, the French had the green light to exploit resources and control financial flows. The colonial authorities decided to organize the protectorate by relying on local leaders, officials that were appointed with their own troops in different regions across the territory, essentially trying to keep control while appearing hands off. But this didn't go down well with many tribes, and understandably so. In Atlas al-Mutawassit, for example, the French colonial forces often clashed with tribes that resisted their rule. And when those tribes would say, hey, we didn't sign up for this, we're not even on good terms with the Sultan, so whatever he signed doesn't apply to us, the French did not hold back. Depending on how violent the resistance was, the French would use brutal tactics. Even though to this day, people like to quote Marshal Lyautey, who was the French resident general in Morocco and who claimed he was against all use of excessive violence in Morocco, that he was more interested in bringing order and civilization and modernization through diplomacy and cooperation, that this wasn't Algeria 2.0. On paper, his strategy, known as La Doctrine Lyautey, focused on indirect rule and working with local leaders to maintain stability, which would sometimes work. Many Moroccans across the territory actually cooperated and collaborated with the colonial forces. However, the reality on the ground often told a different story. Without getting into too much details, the reality was that the French military used a strategy called La Tache d'Huile, the oil stain, which consisted in attacking one region at a time and completely isolating defeated tribes from those that were still rebelling to prevent any group effect. Essentially, the message of France back then was no violence as long as you put your sovereignty in a cute little bag and you gift it to us. Fun times. The central government often turned a blind eye to the struggles of tribes, so they were cornered, found themselves fighting not only against one of the most powerful empires in the world that was well established in North Africa back then, but also a central authority that didn't mind them being silenced for a bit. When people think about the Moroccan national resistance against European occupation in the 20th century, they naturally think eloquent men in suits fighting a political battle, or brave, organized troops putting their lives on the line in the physical battlefield. Our minds go straight to that scenery, and rightfully so. Moroccan nationalism and the liberation movement were indeed two major avenues that led Morocco to its independence. But surely, they weren't the only ones. Battles needed to be led on many other fields in order for the owners of the land to triumph over those who were politically or economically trying to steal it. And as funny as it sounds, history doesn't remember much. On the topic of anti-colonial struggles in Morocco, it pushes out the actions and perspectives of an upper-class urban elites for everyone to see and praise, which, don't get me wrong, are of extreme value. But again, if there's one thing we know about history, it is that it's a human construction that retains little. For as soon as it is within reach of the victors, the winners, they seize it and they jump on the opportunity to weave a narrative from what they deem worthy of preservation. They broadcast it, promote it, shout it from the rooftops, until soon the tide of forgetfulness sweeps away everything they chose not to save, or they couldn't save. That is if we do nothing about it, which thankfully isn't the case for the story I'm about to share with you today. Tawgret Ultaïssa was an Amazigh woman. She lived and was brought up in a small village called Erbela, nestled on the slopes of Atlas al-Mutawassit, in the Bnimlal Khnifra region. She came from the tribe of the Eight Sukhmen, a very sporadic lineage established in the region since the 17th century. The name Eight Sukhmen comes from the Temezigt Izmaren, plural of Izmach, which means black, hinting that the Eight Sukhmen considered themselves to be the descendants of black people, whatever that means. As a child, Tawgret was quick to face hardships. So many setbacks in life, challenges she couldn't really avoid, bullets she had no way to dodge. But we'll see how she didn't see them as such. For to achieve the greatness she has, one must have unshakable confidence. For starters, as we already mentioned, she was blind and had to navigate community life that way. She was also orphaned of father, which came with its fair share of challenges. The latter died in unknown circumstances before she could even walk. Her mother quickly took on both parenting roles, and she must have done it with the utmost grace, given the woman she ended up raising. Tawgret, like most women of her time, lacked the opportunity for education and remained pretty much all her life illiterate. Her blindness likely played the biggest role in preventing her from ever acquiring that ability, but it certainly didn't stop her from turning words into weapons for her ideas. She became a respected poetess of passion and truth, and a singer of Ehidus, the traditional Amazigh dance and music. She was held in high regards by her people, seen as a pillar for her tribe and neighboring villages as well. The lifestyle of Tawgret Ultaïssa contrasted in such a unique way with the woman of her time. And by that, I do not mean she lived better or worse, no judgment here, I'm just stating facts. Because Tawgret Ultaïssa never married. Researchers have also noted that in the Eight Sukhmen tribe, it was more common to find women that were equal to men in the sense that they were active participants in public life, which probably made it even easier for Tawgret to enjoy the status she had. Not only did she live freely, but she was also known for offering generous hospitality to men of her tribe, who were used to seeking wisdom in her company. And most importantly, Tawgret composed her own poems, which was rare for women back then. As we've seen, Tawgret Ultaïssa is truly a force of nature, and she has many strengths, the biggest one probably being how uncompromising she was. In her poetry, which she would mostly perform during Ehidus gatherings, Tawgret Ultaïssa would put words onto the realities she experienced firsthand. To her core, she carried deep bitterness and anger from the tiring and relentless efforts of the French forces to make every single Amazigh tribe of the region kneel and submit to colonial rule. But French colonizers were not the only targets of her fury. She equally criticized the French and her own people. Not all of them, the traitors, the cowards, as she called them. herself, not me. Her verses were like a mirror held up to her community, forcing them to confront their own reflection, their own truth. She condemned Amazigh soldiers across the region who surrendered and bowed to colonial forces, all while urging women to take up arms in resistance and fight for their families and for their land. Her poetry ranged from accusations to messages full of hope, designed to soothe and appease her people's anxiety about an uncertain future. Let's go through some of her verses to show you exactly what I mean when I say she had a broad vision of what was unfolding around her. In one of her poems, she describes the brutal treatment of Moroccan tribesmen by colonial forces. However, her pointing fingers at the enemy didn't mean she was going to turn a blind eye on the responsibilities that fell on her people's shoulders, that she wasn't going to hold her own accountable. She criticized some of the countrymen that remained indifferent to the suffering around them. Her lyrics go like this. The countries have broken up, the word was terrible, and yet they all just throw the straps of their bags over their shoulders. She denounces those who collaborated with the enemy and submitted to the colonial forces. I will see our feet swell, bitten by hunger. I swear that access to paradise requires sacrifices. Oh dogs, you who have submitted. She sarcastically called out what we call today the Askesers, the people who only talked about praising the rulers. Oh my god, your name is never mentioned when they talk to each other. It is always about the Hakim, as if he were the one who gave birth to them. But Tawqrat Ultaysa isn't just passively pointing fingers. She's proactive in calling for women to fight. Tudda, get out, call Izza, Ito and the others. Let women take up arms and wave the flags. Tawqrat Ultaysa sets the bar for what a truly revolutionary spirit should be speaking into existence. She refuses to accept any external control over her tribe's sovereignty, but makes it clear that if she was to choose who her tribe should bow to, it's a no-brainer, anyone but the French. I would rather dress in rags and live among Muslims than be a messenger for the French. She vows to continue fighting, even in the most imminent death. Our land, which leopards have gifted us with pride. If they kill us by day, at night, our shadows will chase them away. Tawqrat Ultaysa was humiliated by the fact that Moroccans all across the territory were collaborating with the French because of poverty, and one poem in particular expresses that. When I'm buried, oh hell, burn my belly first. Let the embers devour my entrails that famine drove to the enemy. She viewed any interactions with the colonizers as degrading, and she also provides a critique of those who fled instead of resisting. O you of my community, call Haddu Ikhlift himself and a few from his clan. He fled, and Uhnin, he took refuge with the Eight Ebdi after sacrificing a sheep. He left his kids behind, who were brought back by Sidi along with Wild Mamun. Following the defeat of her tribe around 1930, Tawqrat had to leave Erbala and took refuge in Tunfit. She was much older and embittered by this time, and she continues to write. Speaking of Tunfit, she writes, "Is there anything to eat there? Still, I'll go there head first." However, the warm welcome she received in Tunfit and all the surrounding tribesmen and women that came to see her provided some comfort. Tawqrat enjoyed great prestige in her new home, with villagers visiting and offering her so many gifts in hopes of hearing, and I quote, a word from Tawqrat. Temezigt poetry was typically performed with music. These performances, such as the Ehidus as we mentioned, required a very involved audience, which made it a great arena for exchanging ideas, stories. It fostered the sense of we're all in this together, we're a community. The attendees were encouraged to clap and dance and sing along, which would bring them together around the lyrics. So this oral tradition not only served as entertainment, but also as an amplifying platform for messages to be conveyed, as a way to transmit historical knowledge, social norms to younger and older generations. Now, you might wonder, where do all these details come from? Obviously, researchers do a great job, but the biggest part of her story was mostly preserved by a French historian and soldier, François Régnier, who collected her chants and poems during his mission in Morocco between 1926 and 1930. And boy, was he impressed. He was amazed by the woman, who wouldn't be? To quote him, he said her verses were sometimes epic and filled with imprecations, sometimes lyrical and filled with nostalgia. Régnier also made it a point to debunk a rumor surrounding her name. I mean, sure, Théogrette had so many admirers, but her marvelous imagination, as Régnier called it, also made some folks uneasy, uncomfortable. So, what people do when they're uncomfortable, they run their mouth. Made all sorts of claims that she was a prophetess, a sorceress, that she must have been encroached in some dark magic. But Théogrette Ultaïssa was none of those things. She was a mind that worked fast and well. An Amazigh woman with extraordinary creative power. He acknowledged that Théogrette was the enemy of the French, as her chants and poems complete the history of anti-colonial struggles in Morocco. By detailing the efforts of rural, marginalized communities often overlooked in mainstream narratives. For centuries, oral literature in various Temazight languages was the primary dominant form of expression amongst the Imazighan people. The decline of the Tifinagh alphabet and the widespread illiteracy during the 20th century meant that written literature in Temazight was pretty much non-existent. Nonetheless, Temazight's poetry is rich and varied, does include different ranges from lyrical to epic to narrative to religious. It does address the most common themes we see in written literature, such as joy, love, homesickness, grief, death, sorrow, and resistance to colonial oppression. Théogrette's story doesn't end with her passing, or so we need to make sure, as humanity can simply not afford for such stories of resilience to fall into oblivion. Thanks to her contributions, we gain a deeper understanding of the many ways in which resistance movements were shaped in Morocco.